Have you ever had to face a decision on whether to put a loved one on life support or make the decision to take a loved one off of life support? We are going to talk about these heart-wrenching decisions this hour and how culture and religion and bioethics play a role in them. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, January 13th. I'm glad to be back with you after a very cold and icy staycation last week. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster and John Munson for filling in for me. And thanks to my producers, Robin Cherry, Christy Taylor, and Bill Martins for keeping an eye on them. There are at least two cases getting national attention recently involving people who have been declared brain dead by doctors, but are being kept on life support for different reasons and with different wishes from their families. And we will wonder what you think is right, is moral, is ethical. Is there anything wrong with the family of a young California girl who was declared brain dead following complications from a tonsillectomy, wanting to keep their child on life support? Is there anything wrong with a Texas law that is stopping a family from removing a pregnant woman from life support? She is brain dead, but her fetus is not. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Dr. Art Dursey, the director of the Center for Bioethics and Medical Humanities and a professor of bioethics and emergency medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Let's talk first a little bit about each of these two cases. We have Jahi McMath, a 13-year-old girl in Oakland, California, who was declared brain dead after complications from this tonsil surgery. Tell us what happened there.
Sure. So she was having problems with sleep apnea, and it was recommended that she have a tonsillectomy, among other procedures, which are usually very safe, don't usually have complications, but in this case, unfortunately, had some major complications, bleeding, and a period of time where she was not breathing and her brain was unable to receive oxygen. And so the complications occurred. About 3 days later, she was declared brain dead. She was on a ventilator. Her heart was still beating. Her body was still warm, but the tests showed that her brain had died. And her brain, once the tests are done, this is not like a coma where, you know, she's temporarily unconscious and she'll come back up. And it's not like something called persistent vegetative state, which Terry Schiavo, if you remember that case, mm-hmm. was in, where her parts of her brain were still functioning. The brain stem was still functioning. So she had things that she was able to, you know, track things, and she had some reflexes still. Ms. McMath doesn't have any reflexes at all. And when she has a buildup of carbon dioxide in her bloodstream, people, even with minimal brainstem function, do sense that, and they start breathing faster to be able to blow off the carbon dioxide. But Ms. McMath did not have that. And so they did a blood flow study, which looks at blood flowing into the brain, and it saw that there was no uptake and no blood flowing through the brain. In essence, the brain had no longer a delivery system for oxygen. So for all those reasons, she was declared brain dead. That being said, the heart is still beating. Amazingly, we have hearts that take the lack of oxygen much better than our brains do. We are able to resuscitate hearts. Cardiopulmonary resuscitation, people are familiar with that. They see it on TV. Hearts can stop beating and can be resuscitated fairly well, depending upon our technology. In most cases, it doesn't work, but in a significant minority of cases, it does. So the heart's extremely resilient. And then, of course, we're now able to breathe for people using a ventilator and an endotracheal tube, where back in the day, if your heart was still beating but you were unable to breathe, you eventually wouldn't be able to deliver oxygen to your heart, and your heart would stop as well. So the conundrum here is, back in the day, there was only one standard for death. It was heart-lung death or cardiopulmonary death. Mm-hmm. And a coroner or medical examiner would confirm the death, but death had occurred, and people understood it. They realized what it was. They would put a mirror in front of someone who was breathing, and if they weren't breathing, you could tell that they would die or were already dead, because people knew heart-lung death. But once we're able to resuscitate and to do so well at reviving hearts, our concentration now looked at the brain, because the brain is so much more sensitive to lack of oxygenation. And in the 1960s, there was an additional standard for death. So in addition to cardiopulmonary death or heart-lung death, there was now another standard called brain death that said when the brainstem and all functions of the brain had ceased irreversibly, the person was declared dead. And it was in part because we were now with these cases where people had been resuscitated, their bodies were being supported, but it was recognized that their brain and they had died. And then secondly, there was this movement to transplant organs, and you obviously can't take a vital organ, something that's keeping someone alive, from someone who is alive. And so people who were declared brain dead were found to be and thought to be legally and ethically able to be used as organ donors. And so after brain death, you could harvest a heart, you could harvest lungs, things that were keeping the body alive, but not the brain.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing here is that not everybody has always accepted that brain death is death. Some cultures, some religions don't recognize the lack of brain function and the death of the brain as the death of the person. They see the heart beating and breathing activity, even if it's being mechanically made, as the fact that the person is still alive. So in this case, the doctors and the coroner for the county have declared Ms. McMath dead. So she actually has a death certificate. But the family and others who are helping her say, no, you just don't have enough faith that this is going to work out. She's on a ventilator. Her heart's beating. As far as we're concerned, she's still alive.
And her family went to court and did win the right to have Jahai transferred to another facility. And if I read the press accounts correctly, this other facility did insert a feeding tube. And the last update I saw was the lawyer for the family saying she's doing better. What can you tell us about that?
Well, that's as much as I know, too. So the feeding tube, it's possible that the feeding tube will keep the body without the brain functioning for a longer period of time. The fact is that the nutritional needs of the body are obviously a lot less, since there's no activity, there's no movement, there's no use of a lot of energy. But it is true that that may help to keep the heart and the lungs and the body alive for some period of time. It turns out that when people have wanted to be able to keep the body going, even though the brain has died, you can keep that body going for days, weeks, sometimes months. And in cases where family members and others and let's say the doctors have agreed that the person is brain dead, but for reasons such as keeping the fetus alive, that people want to continue the treatment of, in this case, a woman, a patient who has died, they keep the body going because it's like an incubator, and then you're able to deliver later. However, no body can be kept alive indefinitely when someone is brain dead, because there are some important functions of the brain that keep the body and its endocrine regulation, its regulation as far as vasovagal tone or the tone of your veins and arteries, things that are basic neurological functions that your body no longer has. So sooner or later, the body will deteriorate, but because of our great technology, that can be weeks or in some cases months.
We're going to take a short pause, and then we will continue talking about these end-of-life issues with Dr. Art Dursey, the director of the Center for Bioethics and Medical Humanities and a professor of bioethics and emergency medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And we welcome your questions. We welcome your views on this in terms of the family that wants to keep their daughter on life support, even though she has been declared brain dead by doctors, actually had a death certificate issued. And we'll talk more when we get back about this other case in Texas, where a Texas law is stopping a family from removing a pregnant woman from life support. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. When should someone who has been declared brain dead be kept on life support? We are talking about two different cases getting national attention these days involving people who were put on life support, but the wishes of the families in each case are different. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question or a thought on this. Do you think this should be up to the family entirely? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Dr. Art Dursey. He is a professor of bioethics and emergency medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin and the director of the Center for Bioethics and Medical Humanities. Well, let's talk a little bit more about this second case that's in the news with the 33-year-old Texas mother, pregnant with her second child, pronounced brain dead after she collapsed in her home. She was 14 weeks pregnant. The husband says that she would not want to be kept on life support. The family wants to take her off life support, but apparently a Texas law says no, Dr. Dursey?
Well, this one is even more complex because, so as far as we know, she is brain dead. Her husband is telling us that. The officials are actually saying that she's in serious condition without going into more information about it. But if she is brain dead, so we'll take her husband and her husband's attorney's statement as true. If she is brain dead, the question is whether she's covered by the Texas Advanced Directives Act. So the Advanced Directives Act is an act in which individuals in a state can make out a directive in advance about what they would like if they are no longer able to speak and they're in they're decided to be non-decisional and they're in a life-threatening situation. Texas has an additional provision that says, if I am pregnant, then this act does not have effect. So in essence, you can't make decisions about someone who is pregnant, who is facing end of life. The theory, I think, being that, well, in that case, there's two lives at stake, so you can't just make a decision with one life. Now, interestingly, Wisconsin has a different view, which says I either can have the person who is deciding for me make decisions, and they check that box when I'm pregnant, or they cannot. So Wisconsin gives the individual a choice to make that decision, but Texas doesn't. It takes it away. It just says if you're pregnant, then you can't make any decisions. Interestingly, the Advanced Directives Act applies to persons, and if Marlies Munoz is dead by brain criteria, by the brain death criteria, then she is no longer a person, and her husband certainly could ask for her body to be disconnected from the life-sustaining medical treatment, which is exactly what he's doing. And that's the setup for the conflict in Texas, is the hospital erring on the side of continued treatment in this case of what appears to be a brain dead individual, and the husband saying she would not want this and, you know, stop this, and oh, by the way, she's dead and this act doesn't apply to her because the Advance Directives Act only applies to a living person who's unable to make decisions about themselves. So it is ironic that at the very same time, the McMath family is saying, I know you're telling us that she's dead, but as far as we're concerned, she's alive. We want this treatment. And in the Munoz case, the hospital it may be saying, yes, you're telling us that, you know, you don't want this treatment. However, we're going to continue because we want to be able to get this fetus to a stage in which it might be delivered. And at the time that this happened, she was 14 weeks pregnant. She's now over 20 weeks pregnant. Obviously, obstetricians would prefer to deliver a near-term baby for the best possible outcome, but they have been able to, perinatologists have been able to resuscitate and treat infants as young as 23 weeks. So they're getting to a stage where if there was a delivery, there might be the possibility of survivability. But the issue, of course, is whether or not, one, she is brain dead, which from all accounts have been in the press, she is, and the hospital has encountered that. And then, secondly, can they keep the body alive, even though she has died, to be able to, in this case, force the husband to, you know, become a father, and for the patient who has now died to have a child who will be born after her death, interestingly.
We have full lines, so let's try to get to some calls before our news break. Bethany in West Bend is with us. Hello, Bethany. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
And what a wonderful topic to be discussing this early. I'm a health educator, and I work with students who are looking at pursuing health careers. And interestingly enough, this is a unit that we are in medical ethics. And I have a question with regard to young people, 17, 18, 19-year-olds, and having their advanced directives and power of attorneys in place prior to going off to college, in the event that something would happen. And it was interesting to hear that you said that it's applies only to living individuals for those decisions. So I'll hang up because I'm en route, and I'll listen to your response.
Well, I do want to say that advance directives do apply to individuals and also to the disposition of their bodies after they have died. So an advance directive can contain whether or not you want to be an organ donor, and whether or not you want your tissue to go to a tissue bank after you have died. So there are some things that you can indicate in advance directive that are preferences about what will happen to your body. In general, and actually fairly specifically, advance directives apply to adults because these are decisions that we think only adults should make, so that an adolescent at this time in Wisconsin can't make an advance directive. You have to be 18 years old to be able to fill it out. Otherwise, the decision about what would happen to an adolescent or a child is dependent upon both what the treating physicians and the parents, you know, come up with and agree about. But I do think it's a very good point that young people, just as they going off to school or headed off to adult life, want to get a lot of things in place for themselves. This is a document that is extremely helpful, an advance directive, either a power of attorney for healthcare or also something known as a living will. But that gives the power to, you know, your agent, mm-hmm. often a family member or a parent or relative, to be able to make medical decisions for you when you're no longer able to. Because at 18, you are able to make medical decisions about yourself. And if you're no longer able to make them and you're facing a critical life-threatening problem, You do want someone who knows your values, knows what's important to you, to be able to stand in your place to express what you want under the circumstances. In Wisconsin, without an advance directive, and for an adult, there's not a hierarchy or an implication about who makes decisions for you. You either have to have a guardian appointed or have to have some kind of a decision made by a medical team about what's going to happen, but it's an important document to have. So I'm so glad you're raising these issues with your students. I'm so glad that you are talking about advance directives and advance care planning. But once someone has died, an advance directive is no longer helpful about what type of medical treatment they should have, because technically they have died. And again, it's just a real conundrum in this case that there is a death certificate. A coroner has attested that this young girl has died, and yet at the same time, the parents have a body that's warm, the heart's beating, and the
lungs are going through such grief right now. Let's hold it there for now, because we have news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio coming up, and then we'll be back talking more about bioethics with Dr. Art Dursey. A 13-year-old girl in California and a pregnant woman in Texas are both on life support, both reportedly brain dead, and both have different wishes from their families. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about when someone who has been declared brain dead should be kept on life support and how culture and religion play a part in these decisions. And we're welcoming your thoughts and your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Art Dursey. He is the director of the Center for Bioethics and Medical Humanities and a professor of bioethics and emergency medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And Dr. Dursey, let's start off this segment with this Facebook comment from a listener who simply writes, "It should be a family decision, period." What say you to that?
Well, I think in some cases that's true, but I think for the declaration of death, we should have a community-wide, legally recognized definition, because the difference between life and death for an individual is so important, but also for society. It has to do with a lot of things as far as people's legal status. You know, will insurance still pay for a body that's brain dead, but is being supported with all this highly technical and very expensive technology? The answer is in some cases no, right? Because insurance companies don't have responsibilities to cover an individual's medical costs once they have died. If someone intentionally, and this should not happen, but intentionally came up and pulled the ventilator from a brain-dead patient's body, would that be intentional homicide? The answer is no, because the law has recognized that person as having died, even though the family, of course, would be very upset in this case because their strong belief is that the person is alive, but a prosecutor isn't going to be able to make a case and wouldn't. They might for a number of you know, tort claims or civil wrongs, but it's not a criminal wrong to disconnect life support from someone who is dead. So for all sorts of, I think, very important legal and societal reasons, we should have a common definition, and we do. All states have statutes or common law on brain death and as a form of death, and they, in most all of the states, recognize either that heart-lung death or brain death, whichever occurs first, as being death. But the other thing as well is There is a question of the resource use, which, of course, many people are sensitive about and say, well, wait a second, you know, like, well, you're talking about rationing, you're talking about, you know, allocating at the bedside. But if you have a now dead patient who's being ventilated, who is being supported on this, you know, bodily life-sustaining technology, again, right, not brain-sustaining, but bodily-sustaining technology, those resources cost, those resources have to be paid for from somewhere. And if you had another patient who needed a bed in the ICU and your ICU was filled, many people would say, stop all that stuff because it's treating someone who has died. But, of course, the family wouldn't see it that way. They would say, we were here first, too bad, so sad, but, you know, you with the heart attack, you know, we got here first, and this is our loved one who needs this technology very much. So the reality is that there are costs to doing this. Now, I also recognize that some people say, well, aren't there costs for organ transplantation when you keep a body alive for that purposes? And the answer is yes. And those costs are borne sometimes by the insurance companies, sometimes by the organ procurement organization. But the fact is that at some point, we do have to have a definition of when someone has died. I think families should be very involved in decisions before death, and I think families should be very involved in the decisions about what should be done with the body after death. But I don't think, I think the determination of death is a medical decision, not a family decision.
Lou in Oconomowoc is with us now. Hi, Lou.
Hi. I was just telling your producer there, isn't it funny? We've got these two families. Basically, the one family out in California that want, you know, their wishes are being overridden by, you know, by a hospital and for money reasons. And then we've got these that gal down in Texas who's their family's wishes are being overridden by, you know, the state. Two very powerful entities making decisions for the individual. And at the end of the day, you stand and scratch your head and you go, well, you know, it's really not about the individual or the families. It's about somebody more powerful further up the food chain that's actually going to make the choice. And I stand and scratch my head. And this is a conundrum that, you know, when we get into this bioethics stuff, this is a conundrum that, yeah, you basically kind of created for yourself. Thank you.
Money and power decides, Dr. Dursey?
Well, there's no question that there are issues about, we'll say, financing things, because you can't, you know, just do things without finding some source of funding for it. And, you know, if it's you're coming to the emergency department and you're having to pay more because the hospital is subsidizing, you know, a technological intervention, that's, you know, somehow the money will be found and shifted for that. As far as power goes, well, so you do give government and you do give the legislature the ability to make laws about this. So, yes, you know, like ultimately it is about the legislature deciding about it. And, you know, we may not like what Texas is doing. We may like Wisconsin approaches better, but both are legislatively enacted and I imagine judicially tested, but at least both legislatively enacted statutes that, you know, we have to live within. So, sure, there's issues of money and there's issues of power, as in governmental power. Ultimately, of course, whatever the power was in California, the hospital wanted to stop the treatment, but a judge said, no, you have to negotiate a settlement. And the settlement that was negotiated was that Ms. McMath was transferred to another facility. The parents haven't disclosed where that is. But the reality is that the hospital there didn't make the ultimate decision. The family has made the decision. And I think, you know, we will be hearing at some point about this young girl's death. But in this particular case, they were able to assert that. In Texas, we don't know how that will play out, but at least right now, it is true that the hospital is ultimately forcing the treatment over the objection of the husband. But when your caller said, you know, this is the hole that we've dug ourselves into, so to speak, you know, a fine mess we've gotten ourselves into, you know, the reason we've gotten into this fine mess is our technology is so good. We are so good at resuscitating people, at keeping their hearts alive, even when their brain is not able to get oxygen, to be able to get oxygen in their heart and resuscitate their hearts, that we've gone down this road and, you know, we're not going back. You know, people like technology. It's brought wonderful gifts to individuals. It's brought longer length of life to patients. And ultimately, it is true that we have gotten these problems along with our great technology, but it's a price that most of us are willing to pay. You know, our great ability to resuscitate, we have a chance of bringing someone back who stops breathing and whose heart stops beating in a way that before these technologies were available, that person would have died. If we didn't have a ventilator to keep someone alive, that person would have died. So, yeah, we've walked down that road, and I have to say that these issues are difficult ones, and they're ones that, you know, are vexing, but in essence, you know, the blame in part is on us, but technologically, we want to go down this road. We want to be able to do that. And by the way, we'd really love to be able to turn around that brain injury from the lack of oxygen. And the better we're able to do that, it's possible that in an aftermath of the complications of the surgery that Ms. McMath underwent, better techniques for delivering the oxygen for resuscitating her would have helped her brain, and the same with Mrs. Munoz. So, yeah, I agree that, you know, we definitely, you know, we're stuck with the results of our technology, but I don't think that necessarily means that we can't figure these out or we shouldn't figure these out. I think we need to and we have to.
We had a caller who couldn't hold on who wanted to know who is paying for the treatment.
So it's a great question because everything ultimately does get paid for somehow, or it's donated by, you know, some group that is obviously getting the money from other ways. But the short answer to that question is, to my knowledge from reports, is that it varies. Sometimes insurance companies will pay for a short period of time for the technology that would keep a brain-dead person supported during the time that they're making decisions about it. For the long term, as in the McMath case, if there is insurance for that, I don't think that the insurance company would continue to pay for treatment for a patient who has died. So who's picking up the tab? It's a good question. In general, if it's not being picked up by the insurance company, it's being picked up by the institution through other means, and that's generally charging other patients that the institution treats. So those costs, if not paid for by insurance, and there's no legal obligation for insurance to do so after a patient's brain death, then we're picking up that cost.
We are talking about these two cases getting national attention recently involving people who have been declared brain dead by doctors, at least reportedly, a woman in Texas, a pregnant woman in Texas, and a 13-year-old girl in California. They are being kept on life support for different reasons and with different wishes from their families. And we're wondering what you think is right and what questions you have. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes before 7 o'clock on this Monday, January 13th. We are talking about end-of-life issues and these two cases that have been in the news involving a 13-year-old girl in California and a pregnant woman in Texas who have been declared brain dead but are on life support. We are talking with Art Dersey, the director of the Center for Bioethics and Medical Humanities and professor of bioethics and emergency medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And we welcome your questions, your views on the ethical issues involved here. Is there anything wrong with the family of this young California girl from wanting to keep their child on life support, even though a death certificate has been issued? She's brain dead. What about this Texas law that apparently is stopping a family from removing a pregnant woman from life support? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Dersey, let's talk a little bit about the different cultural or religious reasons that are playing a role in these cases, especially in the case of the girl in California. Why might her family not trust the doctors in declaring that their daughter is brain dead?
Well, I think there are some issues that are very legitimate issues that, you know, can be raised. And in some cases, in inaccurate diagnoses of things like persistent vegetative state, a diagnosis of coma, there have been cases where the doctors have been wrong. So just to start out right there, any family member might say, well, in this case, the doctors are just plain wrong. She's not brain dead. Her brain is still intact, and we just have to wait for that to show up. In tests about brain death, actually, they're extremely accurate if done correctly, and no one has come back from brain death who's been accurately diagnosed to a degree that's very different from all the other cases dealing with coma or persistent vegetative state. So that's one issue. The other issue is that for some minorities, there have been times in the past where they have had legitimate complaints about being differentially treated from the medical care system. And in this particular case, you might not trust that the people who are declaring brain death are doing it in the best for the best interests of you and your family. I do think with brain death that that is something, when I said before, it's good to have a law and it's good to apply it uniformly. I do think that's true, that it should be uniform for, you know, whomever is the patient in the bed, that brain death is brain death. There are also religious objections to brain death. There are some religions, and Orthodox Judaism is one that traditionally has recognized heart-lung death or cardiopulmonary death. And in New York and New Jersey, there are actually exceptions in which those communities have the ability to have that belief respected. Now, that's not true in California. That's not true in Texas. Not true in Wisconsin. But for those states, those legislatures have said, well, in that case, you need to respect those beliefs as well. So it is true that in some states there would be an accommodation, although at least in New Jersey it's a religious accommodation. It's not a belief system in which you just say, oh, I don't agree with your diagnosis. But there are reasons why, you know, individuals or families could assert that, yeah, you say that the person's brain dead, and maybe they are, but we don't believe in that. In fact, I have a colleague in emergency medicine who believes just the opposite. She says she no longer believes in heart-lung death, cardiopulmonary death, because we're so good at resuscitating the heart. She only now believes in brain death because she knows that if someone's brain dead, they are dead, which is kind of an ironic opposite view, which is that, you know, the only gold standard of death is when the brain has died.
A caller wanted to know, has anyone been resuscitated after being declared brain dead? Has anybody come back to life because of maybe a mistaken brain death declaration?
And the answer is none that I'm aware of. And of all the tests that are done, this one is extremely accurate, extremely good, because when they do this brain flow study, which is an imaging study, when it shows that the brain is not taking up any blood, that is very much a gold standard. Plus, there are other tests that go along as well. But all that is the brain. If you keep a ventilator on and you supply oxygen to the heart, the lungs still inflate and the heart keeps on beating.
John in Madison is with us. Hello, John.
Yes, what I'm calling about is the recent issue in the news with Ariel Sharon dying after 8 years in a coma. How that plays into this whole ethical dilemma.
I think that's a great question, because that's kind of the third case that's in the news. And so Ariel Sharon was not brain dead. He had some portion of his brain functioning. But people who are in a persistent vegetative state, as it appears that he has been in, those people can be supported for long periods of time. They generally have their own respiratory drive, so they're able to breathe on their own. They have reflexes. They may be able to cough, may be able to track visually. And the biggest difference, though, is that because of their own respiratory drive, they can survive for many, many years. And in the Terry Schiavo case, the case in Florida with a woman who is in persistent vegetative state, she lived for 15 years when they were litigating about it and had a disagreement about it. Her husband and his wife's family disagreeing about it. But persistent vegetative state, if you attend to the medical issues of the individual and persistent vegetative state, the person is still a person, still a live person, considered that way in law and ethics, you can keep them going for many, many years.
Yeah, Dr. Dursey, we have just a minute left. Can you give us sort of a short takeaway from what we're learning from these cases?
Well, I think the short takeaway is, one, people should understand the difference between heart-lung death and brain death. And brain death is something that people do not come back from, and at that point, people have died. Secondly, before death, it's really important to have your wishes known in an advanced care planning document called an advanced directive, a living will, or power of attorney for healthcare, because the brain death cases are fairly uncommon, but the more common situation is when family members are wondering what to do when the patient is not brain dead, but they have some serious injury or they're facing an end-of-life situation and there's no directions to the family about what to do.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Art Dursey, Director of the Center for Bioethics and Medical Humanities, Professor of Bioethics and Emergency Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Thanks to Robin Cherry for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Christy Taylor for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. The State Capitol Report is next. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.